I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The fighting continues in the air and on the ground in Iraq.
Two 4,700-pound bunker buster bombs, the biggest bombs dropped so far in this war, struck a communications tower in Baghdad today.
In the south, British troops are in combat with Iraqi fighters defending the besieged city of Basra, and there are reports of Iraqis firing on civilians attempting to flee.
And the British supply ship Sir Galahad docked at the port of Qasr earlier today, loaded with the first military shipment of relief aid for Iraqi citizens.
While U.S. troops continue increasing their presence in northern Iraq, reinforcing a front that will eventually move toward Baghdad.
We certainly have the ability now to increase our presence in the north with the arrival of the 173rd Airborne Brigade. We continue our efforts to, as much as possible, maintain a degree of stability in the north. More than anything else right now, that's our primary focus.
Brigadier General Vincent Brooks at Central Command in Qatar earlier today.
Well, now joining us on the line from Erbil, northern Iraq, is WBUR's Michael Goldfarb. Michael, it's evening where you are. We hear it's been a long day. What's been going on?
Overnight, there was a fairly heavy and constant thunder of large transport planes coming into the area, and by dawn's light, we could see that vehicles had been dropped down in Harir, the airstrip that the special forces are using. Then there was heavy bombing along in Mosul, and then a ways from me, down towards Sulaymaniyah, the Iraqi army withdrew from its positions near Cham Chamal, and the Kurdish Peshmerga forces took the invitation and advanced about 20 kilometers into what had been Iraqi government territory.
Position Cham Chamal for us, that Iraqi forces front line. How far above Baghdad is that?
Oh, we're still talking about several hundred kilometers. The importance of Cham Chamal is that it's simply a hop and a skip into Kirkuk. Cham Chamal sits at the bottom of a ridge. On top of the ridge was where the Iraqi positions are. Now, this is a very delicate situation, Robin, because Turkish government in particular, but many people would be very concerned about Kurds marching into Kirkuk in advance of its being secured by American forces.
In fact, Michael, we're hearing conflicting reports as to whether or not the Kurds, the Iraqi Kurds in the north, are being encouraged to mobilize. Tell us about that.
Well, the Iraqi Kurds are mobilized. The question is, under whose control? And today at a press conference in Salahuddin, Zalmay Khalilzad, who is the president's special envoy and who was in northern Iraq for a meeting with Iraqi opposition leaders, said that, yes, in fact, that operation had been approved by Central Command.
And what else was going on at that Iraqi opposition meeting?
Interestingly, today, the Iraqi opposition groups issued a call to the people of Iraq, urging them to rise up. And at the meeting, I asked Mr. Khalilzad if that was also the policy of the U.S. government, that people should rise up.
We have not said anything about, you didn't hear from me, Iraqis rising up. We have said the Iraqi forces, that only if they move, it has to be as part of General Frank's command and under his control. I did not say anything about the Iraqis rising up.
Well, Michael, we just heard General Vincent Brooks earlier speaking about stability in the north being a primary focus for U.S. forces. It would sound as if that's what this is reflecting.
Exactly. But it should be said that there is, at the moment, an ongoing operation with U.S. forces and Kurdish fighters in the region inhabited by Ansar al-Islam. This is the radical Muslim group which the State Department has said is the link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. The BBC is reporting that special forces working with Peshmerga guerrillas have actually taken the town where Ansar has been headquartered. It seems likely that many of the Ansar fighters, and we're only talking about several hundred people, will take to the mountains and fight guerrilla action.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Robin.
WBUR's Michael Goldfarb speaking to us from Erbil in northern Iraq.
Well, elsewhere in Iraq, the biggest bombs yet in Baghdad and south of the capital, continuing guerrilla war against coalition troops strung out along a line hundreds of miles long. Joining us now once again to discuss the military situation in Iraq is retired Special Forces Colonel Khalid Sepp. Colonel, welcome.
Hello, Bill.
Colonel, difficult to get a handle on how the coalition's doing in many places. Nasiriyah in central Iraq, for example, U.S. troops will get supplies across key captured bridges, but they constantly come under fire from Iraqis, one soldier describing it as a turkey shoot, often Iraqi fighters in civilian clothing. Let's listen to what Marine Lance Corporal Josh Menard, who was wounded in Nasiriyah, had to say about these forces yesterday.
We were very surprised. We were told when we were going through in Nasiriyah that we should see little to no resistance. And then when we got in, it was a whole different ball game. Received a lot of resistance, and we were more prepared for what happened in the Gulf War, where they more turned over and surrendered most of the time.
Colonel, was this kind of resistance war-gamed, taken into account sufficiently by commanders?
Evidently not. And the commander of the U.S. 5th Corps, Lieutenant General William Wallace, has just said in an interview that they failed to account for this in their war-gaming prior to the
offensive. How could that happen?
Human error, plain and simple. There's and a lot of it is has to do with the senior officers that are involved with this planning, having been veterans of the 1991 Gulf War and having had personally a very different experience with the Iraqis that they fought at that time.
We also hear of the 3rd Infantry up closer to Baghdad running possibly low on food and water.
The modern mechanized armies are extremely thirsty and extremely hungry things. A 250,000 gallons of fuel is required a day for the lead combat elements. The severity of these attacks against the supply lines, although the Iraqis have failed to cut the lines and have made some very serious mistakes in allowing key bridges to fall into Allied hands, at the same time that pressure is now delaying the constant flow of supplies that is needed at the very front.
Let's shift then to finish up to Baghdad, where those huge bombs were used against the city yesterday. But, you know, also yesterday, the Iraqi defense minister, and he's not considered a wild-eyed propagandist, he's considered a serious military man, he vowed to wait out the coalition, force street fighting, house to house. And, you know, if this drags on closer to summer, it's 130 degrees there. Baghdad.
This will be it will be extremely tough. The idea of a siege of the city, which Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld hinted at the other day, would carry into this period of particularly hot weather. If chemical weapons are used during that period, it would force soldiers to operate in the very uncomfortable chemical protective suits and masks.
Yeah, still a tough fight ahead. We'll continue to call on Colonel Sepp to talk about the military landscape in Iraq. Thanks very much, Colonel.
Thanks, Bill.
Former Special Forces Colonel Khalif Sepp joining us again. Thanks.
The UN Security Council is expected today to restart the suspended oil for food program that provides rations to some 16 million Iraqis. The program, suspended on the eve of the war, is likely to be extended for 45 days, but the Security Council remains divided over a host of other issues, including control of a post-war Iraq. Yesterday, Secretary of State Colin Powell said the U.S. was not about to relinquish power to the UN.
We didn't take on this huge burden with our coalition partners not to be able to have significant, dominating control over how it unfolds in the future.
Also at issue now are the questions of who should pay for aid to the Iraqi people and who should get lucrative contracts for rebuilding Iraq. James Bone is with the London Times. He joins us on the line from New York. Hi, James.
Hello there.
Well, tell us further, what are the tensions within the Security Council over restarting aid?
Well, the main tension is that the people on the Security Council who oppose the war, particularly Russia, France, and Syria, don't want to vote on anything that would be seen as legitimizing the war. I mean, the basic idea of this revamped oil for food program is that the aid that goes in will no longer have to go into the Iraqi government. It can go into U.S. and British-controlled areas without the approval of the Iraqi government. And originally the resolution said that the U.N. Secretary-General could coordinate with what was known as the relevant authorities, and that was seen as an implication by the anti-war countries that those authorities had some kind of status in Iraq, which they, of course, don't accept. Now what's happened is that the U.N. Secretary-General has just been given the power to conduct the necessary coordination without saying with whom. And there's also a very explicit reference to the duties of the occupying powers under the Fourth Geneva Convention to provide food and medical supplies to the occupied population.
And that gets to the question of who is going to be paying for this. Kofi Annan, the UN Secretary General, has said in effect that U.S. and Britain are responsible for aid to civilians. So will it be taxpayers in those countries who pay for the aid, or will it be Iraqis through the oil revenues?
Well, it's going to be a mixture of both, really. I mean, the UN today is launching a $2 billion aid appeal. The British and the American governments obviously will give large amounts of aid because they're the ones who need to be seen to be doing something. And then, of course, once you can get oil shipped out again from Iraq, you'll be able to use that money to get aid into areas not controlled by the Iraqi government.
You mentioned the resistance of France and Russia, and some would say that they might be concerned that they might lose pre-existing oil deals, for instance, with any U.S. allied post-war oil ministry.
Yes, well, that's certainly true, and it is true that the Russians particularly have benefited under the oil for food contracts. And it is undoubtedly true that they will probably lose those if a new Iraqi government comes into power who doesn't like the Russians as much.
A couple other issues before we let you go. Yesterday, the senior British military officer in the Gulf attacked U.S. plans to hand control of the important port of Umm Qasr to a U.S. company instead of to the Iraqis. What do you think of that?
Well, I think the British and the Americans have a difference on post-war reconstruction. The Americans seem to want to give all the contracts to American companies. The British would be much happier if it were done more through the UN and there was a more widespread distribution of these very lucrative reconstruction contracts. That we'll be seeing a lot more of in the future, those divisions.
There are also reports that the Bush administration is divided over the possible return of weapons inspectors to the area. What's being said about this at the UN?
Yes, I mean, that's another interesting issue that there seems to be a clear division between the British and the Americans on. The idea is that the weapons inspector's mandate still continues, even though they've been withdrawn from the country. And if there are fines of weapons of mass destruction, the best thing is to invite them in to verify those fines and then report them to the Security Council under the existing UN resolution. Basically, that would, in terms of history, do something to justify the war that was launched to disarm Iraq of its weapons of mass destruction. The Americans have their own teams of inspectors down there. In fact, the Americans seem to want to check the weapons of mass destruction and prove the weapons of mass destruction there themselves, whereas the British and even the Kuwaitis are talking already about inviting the weapons inspectors back.
Well, James Bone, thank you.
You're welcome.
James Bone is New York correspondent with the London Times.
So what are your thoughts as the second week of war now draws to a close? We've asked you to email us today, and one of the first emails of many we've received from Karen Maddox, who wrote us to say, "The various networks have all clamored to have reporters embedded to report on this war. It's being treated as a commercial opportunity in a horrific way. It's not the Olympics we're watching. This is not entertainment."
What do you think about any aspect of the war? Send us your thoughts either to letters at here-now.org or go to our website, here-now.org, and click on forums. We'll share as many thoughts as we can during the program, so let us hear from you.
Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The Iraq War is being fought on another front besides armed combat. The other line of fire is considerably safer, but still heated. Media skirmishes. The on-again, off-again push and pull between military officials and journalists embedded alongside troops. Yesterday at a briefing, Brigadier General Vincent Brooks described how movement of a large Iraqi armored column became news that spread fast around the world, then turned out to be not true.
Because we have embedded media, and they're reporting what the unit was sensing at that point in time. A very classic example of how the world looks from down on the line.
Another media dust-up happened when a reporter received applause for questioning why the man who's running the war, General Tommy Franks, doesn't show up more often for briefings in front of the million-dollar television backdrop built for briefings in Qatar.
General Franks, he's already shown that he's more than willing to come and talk to you at the right time, but he's fighting a war right now, and he has me to do this for him.
So, media and the war. The topics we're putting before our editorial roundtable this week. Joining us on the line are Randy Wilson, editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona. Hi, Randy.
Hi there, Bill.
And Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Hi, Guy.
Hi, Bill.
Well, I want to talk to both of you about how journalists are doing covering this war. But first, let me mention what you may or may not already know. This morning, a top aide to President Bush told the Associated Press that Bush isn't happy with the media coverage of the war in Iraq. The unidentified aide said Bush is especially rankled at questions about how long the war will last, the president labeling that kind of talk as silly. Randy, your thoughts?
It's hard to label a serious question like that silly. I think what it really means is the president is frustrated by tough questions about strategies and tactics that are being second-guessed by the media, and probably with good reason. It's not been the easy campaign that we may have been led to believe.
Guy, your thoughts?
Well, I don't think the president ought to be spending too much time criticizing journalists, just as I don't think the generals ought to spend any more time than necessary briefing journalists. I mean, there is a war going on, and that's where their attention should lie. We'll take care of the journalism. I've been watching the Canadian television news up here in New Hampshire, and it's interesting that it's slightly removed from the passions of the American networks. And not similarly censored either. They show the good and the bad, and I think the American networks ought to attempt to do the same thing. In other words, not fight the war, but report on it and keep some distance from the passions of the moment.
Is there too much hype around this war, or can there not be too much coverage when we're at war?
Well, I see it in two different realms here. The TV journalists and the TV networks particularly had almost sold their coverage by the advance hype, and they're doing everything they can, I think, to keep those ratings. I think the print reports that I've seen have been a lot more balanced. They've been more analytical, free of the hype, and I think that's going to be the case probably throughout the war here.
You know, Guy, the Washington Post today reports top media consultants are advising TV stations that showing anti-war protests too much drives away viewers and that they should adapt a patriotic tone.
Well, this is disgraceful. And boy, we need all the analysis and all of the passion that we can bring to bear. And I don't think protests are particularly helpful when it's people lying down the street, but I think we need a little more skepticism and a little more context than just these little analyses of which military group is moving in which direction.
Randy, in your community, what's the sense of the concern about the war? Has it darkened in the past week?
I think that's a good term. We have a soldier who is missing in action. She is a Native American, a mother of two. There's been quite a lot of vigils for her and prayer services. And I think it's brought home to the community that war carries risks and it carries fears. This is also a college town that, frankly, wasn't as supportive of the war effort to begin with. I think the two sides are still speaking to each other, but it's getting pretty tense.
Here in New Hampshire, I think that the war is a real problem for just about everybody. There's always the problem with a case like this war where the bad guys are real bad guys.
the peace movement here has been fairly vocal. And I think, I don't know how it is in New Hampshire, Guy, but they had done some civil disobedience. They blocked historic Route 66 for half an hour. But there's some second thoughts now as the reports of casualties come back and whether war protesters can really do that while troops are suffering.
We have the protesters here, too, and they've been stenciling, you know, dead bodies on the sidewalk. My reaction to that, and I don't know, I'm not in favor of this war, so my reaction might not be typical, but my reaction to that is it's silly. Let's discuss this war in prose, you know, and find out what it is we want to do rather than just go out and make life miserable for everybody else.
And those protesters who actually blocked the street have triggered a counter reaction here, which is rare in a college town. There's going to be a mass rally to support the troops in the town square here on Saturday.
And none of it makes any difference.
Just to finish up then, I want to ask you both, how important is it at a time like this to put other news out there, maybe even news that's a bit light, to relieve people from the endless procession of gruesome images at times and uneasiness about this war?
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because as somebody who edits an editorial page, I'll tell you that it is increasingly difficult to find anything about anything else. And there are a lot of things going on, particularly in Washington, that we're going to wake up and find out about later on, that's not getting the analysis and the coverage that it ought to get. And I think it's our job to dig around and try to provide some balance here.
We tried to talk about the annual April Fool's issue this year in a news meeting and had a hard time justifying it. I think we finally decided if we do a joke story, it's going to be on the inside pages this year, not the front page.
Hey, guys, I want to thank you both for speaking with us and look forward to future conversations as this war goes on.
Okay.
Okay, we'll see you, Bill.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks. Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire, joined us from there. And Randy Wilson is editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona, and joined us from Flagstaff.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, one of the intellectual godfathers of the current war in Iraq, Richard Perle, resigns the chairmanship of a key Pentagon advisory group. We'll find out why.
And shock and awe. Just about everybody's heard about this strategic concept, but what is it really, and where did it come from?
These stories and a national day of humility, fasting, and prayer. Coming up here and now.
I'm Ted O'Brien. U.S. officials say the most recent bombing in Baghdad is aimed at disrupting communications between Iraqi leaders and the Republican Guard. Meanwhile, top Iraqi officials continue to report casualties, claiming now that 75 civilians have been killed in an allied bombing across the country. The most intense bombing in the last few days included two 4,700-pound bombs that struck a communications tower in the Iraqi capital. British military officials say they're looking for ways to loosen the grip of Iraqi paramilitary forces on the city of Basra. The British accused the Iraqi fighters of shooting at Iraqi civilians trying to flee the city. U.S. military officials are now investigating them, that a missile fell in southeastern Turkey. The local governor's office in the region claims that four pieces of a missile are spread over a half-mile area outside a southeastern village after two Tomahawk missiles fired from a ship in the eastern Mediterranean this past Sunday landed in the area reportedly without exploding. No injuries were reported. The first military shipment of humanitarian aid has arrived in Iraq. Today, the British supply ship Sir Galahad docked at the port of Umkasar after its path was cleared by a minesweeper. The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones reports the problem now is delivering those supplies to the people.
There is widespread insecurity in the whole of southern Iraq, and it will be quite a tough job to get this safely to the people in need, because, of course, there are civilians who are attacking British soldiers, people dressed as civilians, so it's very difficult for the soldiers who are going to be in charge of this in the first instance to work out who they're dealing with.
The ship carries 230 tons of food, water, medical, and other supplies. Anti-war sentiment is making its voice heard in the Middle East and throughout the world today. In Iran, Egypt, and Jordan, hundreds of thousands have taken to the streets to express their anger at the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, while lawmakers in Pakistan debate a resolution denouncing the war. In South Korea, police scuffled with protesters outside the National Assembly. Residents in Florida are cleaning up today after tornadoes and violent storms wreaked havoc on parts of their state. At least four tornadoes were spotted yesterday, one of them in northwest Miami, knocking down power lines, ripping off roofs, and flattening one home. A 67-year-old man was killed when a tree branch crashed into his living room. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is down 33 points to 8,168. The Nasdaq is off 6 points. This is Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Richard Perle, one of the biggest supporters of the current war in Iraq, has resigned as chairman of the Defense Policy Board because of a growing controversy over his personal business dealings. Perle's resignation comes as a Washington watchdog group releases a report saying that at least 9 members of that powerful board, which advises Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, also have potential conflicts. Kenneth Edelman, former ambassador and arms control director under Ronald Reagan, is a current member of the board. We asked him earlier today about Perle's resignation.
I've known Richard Perle for 35 years. I've never seen that he's come close to violating any rule or regulation that I know of. So people who don't like his politics say that it's an appearance because they can't show that he's done anything wrong.
You were a former arms director under Ronald Reagan. Do you have current business dealings with companies having anything to do with defense or homeland security?
I have for a good number of years, not many of them. I make most of my living doing executive training using Shakespeare, and that's pretty far-fetched from the Defense Policy Board. But I've had companies that over the last years that have been involved in some slight, you know, defense projects. And I was told when I joined the Defense Policy Board that I didn't have to change my behavior at all. What I had to do is make sure that nothing done on the Defense Policy Board was ever going to benefit me or, you know, anything I was involved with in any way. And I've been very scrupulous about that, and I think everybody has.
Kenneth Edelman, current member of the Defense Policy Board. Well, joining us now on the line is Walter Pincus. He reports on national security matters for The Washington Post. And Walter, Richard Pearl is a partner in a company called Trireme Partners. That company deals with goods and services related to homeland defense. So tell us, what was the controversy surrounding his chairmanship of the Defense Policy Board?
Well, it basically focused around a new deal or a new agreement he was about to, he got into, which is to help bankrupt company called Global Crossing, which is trying to sell itself to a foreign-owned company, to get Pentagon approval for that sale. There's a group within the government that has to approve the sale of a company whose activities, in this case telecommunications worldwide, could affect national security. And to have foreign ownership is looked on as a problem, so the Pentagon would have to sign off that this is a transaction they'd allow.
Yeah. And Richard Pearl stood to make $125,000 just for advising the company, but an additional $600,000 if approval came through.
That's correct. His argument is, when I spoke to him yesterday, that the company's in bankruptcy and therefore couldn't afford to pay up front. But that, ironically, he saw his job and carried it out by explaining to the company Global Crossing what they would have to do to get Pentagon approval, not to get the Pentagon to approve what Global Crossing wanted to do.
In Pearl's letter of resignation, he says that he followed the guiding principle while on the board, and that was, you don't give advice on any particular matter in which you have an interest. And he said, quote, I don't do that. I haven't done that. Did he do that?
Well, only he and the Global Crossing people really know that, and the Pentagon people he spoke to. The problem is that the rules are rather loose with this, with these advisory groups, because they're not paid for working for the government. Therefore, they're special employees, and it's an area in which there's obvious potential conflicts. And the regulations don't require them to report as or get clearance for different jobs they take. It just requires them to report annually on who they've worked for.
Yeah. Well, and even on the face of it, if you work for a company, and I'm speaking of Trireme Partners, which deals, as Seymour Hersh recently reported in a pretty damning article, in goods related to defense, and if you're advising a defense secretary on a war, aren't you automatically violating that guiding principle?
Well, the way they look at it, the way Pearl looks at it, and in fact the way the Pentagon looks at it, as he said, it's only if you deal with a specific matter that comes before the board, and since the board's a policy group, it doesn't deal with specific contracts. Trireme, by the way, is not the only company he's involved with. He's on the board boards of several computer companies, or information mining companies, which has become a big business, and several of them have government contracts and with the Pentagon. Mm.
By the way, Pearl remains on the board, even though he's resigned the chairmanship. We mentioned the Watchdog Group report. The Center for Public Integrity has a report being released today in which it says Richard Pearl is not alone with his potential conflict of interest. Nine other members of the board also have personal business that overlaps with the policy that they're discussing.
That's correct. I mean, there are a handful of former high-ranking military officers who serve on this board. Also the former director of CIA, James Woolsey, who works for a company, Booz Allen, that advises government contractors.
Yeah.
And so the conflicts, potential conflicts, are there.
But you know, some would say, isn't it inevitable that people who spend their life in the industry are going to work in the industry? And in fact, isn't theirs perhaps the best advice if they are involved in the industry? In other words, they have experience and expertise and they bring it to the table.
There's no argument that people with that experience shouldn't be on such boards. I think what the public needs to know is, one, for whom do they work? And just have public disclosure, that shouldn't harm anybody. And the second part of it is a sort of recommendation that Senator Carl Levin has made to Rumsfeld, and that is they should sign some agreement that they will not use their position to either gain contracts for their employers or themselves, or to make specific representations to individuals in the Pentagon. In other words, they should be policy advisors, not advisors on specific issues.
Walter Pincus, thank you.
Thank you.
Walter Pincus covers national security matters for The Washington Post. Well, as we occasionally do here at Here and Now, we're holding an on-air forum, this time your thoughts about the war.
Well, Howard Kaplan wrote, Robin, George Bush is a simple man, but he's gotten in with the wrong crowd. We need to liberate George Bush from the terrorist neoconservatives who kept him captive.
Tom Gray writes, I feel that the media is much too focused on trying to prove that the war is not going well for the U.S. and trying to find someone to blame for this.
From Joseph Lee in Rhode Island, I wonder how many of the protesters voted. I'm tired of Americans being up in arms with administrative policies, yet we still have only about 50% participation in the voting process.
And Chuck Tioli writes, I realize there are events happening every half hour in Iraq, but do we need a constant barrage of them? This would also give you a chance to verify reports if you take more time to consider them. The public is tired of the constant war news, and we need some diversions. Well, we would love to hear from you. You can email us at letters@here-now.org. That's HERENOW.ORG. Or go to our website, here-now.org, and click on the forums and join in the discussion. Send us your thoughts about the war. You're listening to Here and Now.
When George W. Bush ran for president, he called for a new humility in U.S. foreign policy. Now, in many places around the world, the U.S. is seen as an arrogant power. Well, in Washington yesterday, the House of Representatives passed a resolution calling for a national day of humility, prayer, and fasting. In this time of war and of terrorism, the president would be called on to issue a proclamation designating a specific day. To discuss this possible National Day of Prayer and Humility, we're joined by South Carolina Republican Congressman J. Gresham Barrett, who voiced support for Resolution 153. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Congressman, does calling for a National Day of Humility imply that the United States could use a dose of humility right about now?
Well, in a lot of people's eyes, that's probably a very fair statement. And, you know, I think being the only superpower in the world, I think maybe sometimes that there may be a case where we think we're a little more important than we actually are. And humility is a wonderful thing. I remember the millionaire that would always go back and shine shoes periodically to remember where he came from. And I think that's so important. It's trying to just pause and reflect and realize that there are forces in this world much stronger than ours. You know, one of the things that I am so proud to tell my people back home is that the people that I'm serving with are morally grounded, ethically grounded, but above all, spiritually grounded. And, you know, religion takes so many shapes, forms, and fashions. It's wonderful for me, being a good old Southern Baptist guy, to realize that so many people that are serving our country have a deep-founded religious background.
Well, there are historical roots for this, Congressman. As you may know, the Continental Congress called for the same thing. Back in 1776, Benjamin Franklin, during debate of constitutional issues at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, called for something like this. And Lincoln proclaimed March 30th, 1863, a day of humility, prayer, and fasting during the Civil War. But, Congressman, what about Americans who are not particularly religious, who may be atheists or agnostics or Muslims, for that matter, religious but not coming out of a kind of Christian tradition? What about them?
Well, you know, certainly I'm not trying to slight anyone. I'm just proud to be a co-sponsor of the bill or the resolution because I think it's the right thing to do. It's the way I was brought up. And if it's a moment of reflection for somebody, just a quiet time for them to think and ponder, you know, the future of this country, so be it. For me, it'll be an actual day of fasting and a day of prayer to keep this country focused on what I think is important.
Congressman, prayer may indeed be a good thing, but should the government be promoting it?
Well, you know, in my opinion, our forefathers were very strong in their belief, and so much of our history proves that. And personally, I think it's a wonderful thing.
When do you think the president might proclaim a day of prayer and humility, if indeed this happens?
I'm not sure. We haven't really talked about that, but I would hope it would be soon. We have so many young men and women in harm's way, not just in the Gulf, but throughout this world.
Congressman Gresham Barrett, we want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
South Carolina Republican Congressman J. Gresham Barrett.
There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
And it's Here and Now.
Shock and awe quickly became the first catchphrase of the second U.S. Gulf War. It was understood by most Americans to mean an awesome display of firepower unleashed on Baghdad and Saddam Hussein. And after the first bombing, many Americans were confused. Some World War II veterans saw more bombing during the Blitz. Well, the man who coined the phrase says there's more to shock and awe than shocking televised images of a city in the missile's red glare. Harlan Ullman is a retired naval officer and a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He co-wrote the 1996 book, Shock and Awe, and he joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Hello, Harlan.
Hello, Robin.
What was your concept? What did shock and awe mean to you?
Well, the way we got to shock and awe was really to ask the question, if Desert Storm were to be refought, could we do it with half the troops in half the time, simply put? And in the mid-1990s, we put together a group of very, very senior retired military officers, and the whole notion was to affect, influence, and control the will and perception of the adversary, not necessarily to destroy all of his forces, and therefore to control his behavior. And the way we reckoned to do that was through shock and awe that would be applied like a blanket of all forms of power selectively and also in terms of awesome displays of firepower. And the idea was that if you could hit a number of key nodes rather than destroy an entire division, they would be so incapacitated, shocked, and incapable of responding that they would offer little resistance or see that everything was futile.
It was more psychological warfare.
A combination. I mean, the best example I can give was the B-52 arc-light strikes in Vietnam, which scared witless the North Vietnamese because they would just be pulverized. If you apply that along with all sorts of other tactics, the idea was to do it so quickly the enemy could not resist and they would either lay down their arms or we would simply arrest them.
And of course, I know some listeners are thinking, well, it didn't exactly work in Vietnam, but you're saying applied with these other ideas of attacking different fortresses.
No, I mean, Vietnam was a military disaster for us, and shock and awe was not applied, but I'm saying in the case of the arc-like strikes, they certainly shocked and awed the North Vietnamese. Now, in this particular war, I'm not sure that if the resistance was going to be so fierce, anything would have worked, but it strikes me, and I'm not second-guessing the commanders, but I was surprised to learn that we had not attacked Ba'athist Party headquarters in either Basra or Nasiriyah at the outstage, and I was surprised that we left the key Republican Guard divisions largely untouched in the early stages of the war.
Because that would have been your concept of shock and awe, hit these different points.
And all of a sudden, let's say that the Iraqi army was either incapacitated or put out of action. All right, Saddam, what are you going to do now? Now, having said that, our forces are so capable and flexible But the fact that we didn't take out the Iraqi army at the outset is really not going to hinder the advance. But the campaign, I think, thus far has had two unfortunate side effects. Shock and awe is perceived as city bombing against Baghdad. I mean, the headlines in Europe, Baghdad Blitz, and front pages of European newspapers are rife with huge colored explosions of Baghdad. So people are thinking we're terrorizing Iraqi citizens when that was not really the effect.
And as a matter of fact, as you comment in today's Wall Street Journal, I'm seeing that often that kind of heavy bombing has the effect of stiffening resistance.
Well, it certainly did in the Blitz.
Well, now, we're curious if you're having communication with the leaders now, because Colin Powell in the past has called you a teacher who raised his vision. So many assume that they took your concept and are implementing it, as you're saying, not entirely. Are you in communication with either Colin Powell or Donald Rumsfeld?
I am, but not on this particular subject. But I think what happened was that people who were advocates of strategic bombing saw this as a great phrase, shock and awe. When we coined it, the phrase was really for internal use in the Pentagon, a soundbite to get people's attention, and it was never meant for public consumption.
Well, in fact, the phrase has offended a few people, and we just want to take the opportunity to say what shock and awe does not mean. Listeners alerted us to a theory running around on the Internet that the phrase shock and awe comes from a Jewish mystical word, shakena, I believe it's pronounced. Well,
and it came here transported on a flying saucer from Pluto. I think that's the other part of the story, but yeah.
Well, I mean, you've heard that.
This is nonsense.
We should say that Avi Matalon, he's professor of Jewish studies at Harvard, tells us the word itself, shakena, refers to the feminine aspect of God's presence, the divine presence of God. Forgive me if I'm not pronouncing it correctly. And these listeners were upset that a phrase with sacred origins would be used to describe bombing and destruction. It obviously has nothing, we repeat, to do with the beautiful Hebrew word. But are you at all concerned that a beautiful word like awe is being used by many Americans now to describe destruction and death?
Well, that the phrase was misused is unfortunate, but we actually use the phrase awe in its complete meaning, that you have positive incentives as well as negative incentives, and our original concept struck both. But no matter what, I mean, to paraphrase Voltaire, figures lie and liars figure, and certainly words can be distorted to be taken out of context, and they will be taken out of context. The important point here is that, you know, whether shock and awe worked or not as was used by the Pentagon, we now are in a really tough fight, and that will certainly not help imposing a just and lasting peace, because animosity and alienation will be considerable, and that's something we have to deal with whenever this war ends.
Dr. Ullman, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
Harlan Ullman, retired naval officer and a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., also co-author of the book Shock and Awe, Achieving Rapid Dominance. Well, we've been holding a bit of an online forum here today on Here and Now. You can continue on our website at here-now.org, click on forums, or you can email us, as several already have. Angel writes, "My own position can best be illustrated by the ribbons I feel I should be wearing, white for peace, pink for the children who are in danger, yellow in hope that our troops will be brought back home."
Well, Robin, John Alex wrote, "As we now witness the blood of coalition troops and Iraqi people being spilt over the oil fields of Iraq, the question rises, what is the true cost of that gallon of high test we are so willing to guzzle?"
Hope Childers of Louisiana State University objected to a comment earlier from a listener that they wanted a diversion from the war coverage. She says, "We must all remember there are no diversions available to the innocent. I pity the poor person who cannot take in the truth. And if you're bored by this distant conflict, too bad."
From Robert Terrell, "The media has done a very complete job of providing us information as to what is happening with the war. Unfortunately, this has overwhelmed news from what is happening in Washington with the budget discussions."
And we hear on our website from Peggy, a member, "I find it astounding and a little more than distressing that so many Americans are out of sync with the rest of the world. Overwhelming majorities of most other countries have strongly opposed this war and, perhaps more tellingly, see a growing threat of U.S. power and aggression." You can join the discussion by going to our website, here-now.org, click on forums, or again, we'd love to hear your emails. You can write to letters at here-now.org, here-now.org.
Before we go, a quick summary of recent developments in the war with Iraq.
The Oil for Food program will be revived despite divisions among Security Council members over the U.S.-led war in Iraq. White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer said so in a statement earlier.
And a cargo of much-anticipated humanitarian aid arrived in the port of Umm Qasr today aboard the British ship Sir Galahad. It took days to clear mines out of the ship's path.
Heavy bombing returned to Baghdad today after a break because of bad weather.
Two 4,700-pound satellite-guided bunker-busting bombs were dropped by a B-2 stealth bomber on a major communications tower in downtown Baghdad.
U.S. officials said that bombing was aimed at disrupting communications between Saddam Hussein's leadership and his military.
And as the fighting intensifies in northern Iraq, Iraqi Kurds are preparing camps to hold as many as 500,000 people fleeing Saddam Hussein's territory. They could face severe shortages of tents and other equipment.
Anti-war protests are continuing throughout the Middle East. Police fired shots in the air and tear gas at crowds in Jordan. And demonstrators broke windows with rocks at the British embassy in Tehran.
And more than 15,000 protesters in Cairo, Egypt, marched and chanted their support of Iraq.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Stay tuned to your public radio station for the latest war developments.
And join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.